just as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence. Work out your salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who is at work in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. Do all things without grumbling or disputing, so that you will prove yourself to be blameless and innocent, and children of God above reproach in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you appear as lights in the world. Holding fast the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I will have reason to glory, because I did not run in vain nor toil in vain. But even if I am being poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrifice and service of your faith, I rejoice and share my joy with you all. You too, I urge you, rejoice in the same way and share your joy with me. So starting in verse 12, so then, my beloved, just as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, accomplish your salvation with fear and trembling. And notice I did a little bit of change there in the translation. All right, but Paul now, he's drawing a conclusion based on that assertion that we saw on who Jesus is. Right? We saw that magnificent statement of Christology. And this is it. So it's on the basis of who he is, and particularly this emphasis of his eternal humility that we saw. But this command here then also picks up from chapter 1, verse 27, and Paul's command there that the Philippians conduct themselves in a manner worthy of the gospel. So this is talking more about what it means to live according to the gospel, worthy of the gospel. Right, and we see the same tender language that Paul has had towards the Philippians. He calls them my beloved. Right. And he says, you need to continue what you've already been doing. He says, just as you have always obeyed. Right? So he's saying, this is what you've been doing. This is the way you've always been. So do more of the same. Right? So this is not corrective. It's not that he's saying you are being disobedient and this is how you need to change. He's exhorting them to carry on. So here the word obedience, all right, it does imply both submission to the authority of God, all right, they are to do what God says, all right, and it also implies obeying, compliance with the commands that God gives. All right. And this, there's an implied subject here, it's not explicit, but this is implied obedience to God. And remember, we just had this example, this magnificent example of Jesus Christ who was obedient even to death. And that's the model that Paul holds up for the Philippians. He says, that's what you want to look like. So now when he says, keep obeying, he's saying, obey God in the same manner, the same way, using that same image as Jesus Christ, that Jesus Christ provides. And then we get to this phrase here that every parent will understand. Every parent can get this. He says, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence. Now, tell me, parents, do you want your kids to obey when you're looking at them? I would assume so. Right. You know, you get the kid that looks right at you and, no, I'm not going to. Right. No, you want the kids to obey in your presence, but the goal is that when they aren't around you, they also do what you've taught them to do. It's no good if they only obey in your presence and then you go away or they go away. They go off to college and they do what you've taught them not to. All right, that's not the goal of training. And Paul's talking to these Philippians and he's saying, you know, you've been obeying in my presence and now that I am away, how much more important is it for you to continue in your obedience? So can someone tell me what the definition of integrity is?
What you do when no one's watching.
That's part of it. What you do when no one's watching. A little bit. I want a little bit more than that.
That's a corporate definition.
Anybody else?
Wholeness being the same in all circumstances.
Pardon me? I'm looking for something along the lines of doing the right thing, doing what is good, what is upright, no matter what your circumstances. All right? You're not under compulsion, not watched. No one aside from God may ever know, and yet you do the right thing. That's integrity. So obedience in the presence is good. Obedience when Paul is apart shows integrity. It shows maturity, that they have learned the lessons that Paul has taught. They are now their own beliefs, their own faith, their own stance as they continue to obey while Paul is away, while he is in prison. So this is that's the how much more. And here, we have that strong contrast that we've seen several times here in Philippians already. But not just in my presence, but how much more while I'm away. And then he says, accomplish your salvation with fear and trembling. All right, so that's Paul's preamble to this exhortation here. And I changed that, accomplish. Some translations say work out. All right, and this is a present tense. It's durative, means it's an ongoing sense of this is what you are supposed to be doing persistently. All right. Now, the salvation that Paul says, he says, yours, and this is you plural. All right. Now, it's not speaking to them as individuals. This is speaking to them as a church. All right. And here we have to look at what's Paul talking about for salvation. What's he mean? All right. And this is not eternal salvation from sin. This is not being delivered from hell. All right. Not being reconciled with God on an eternal basis. Right, he's already talking to believers. Right, he's talking to people who have already put their trust in Jesus Christ. He's talking about salvation from the power of sin. The fact that we still struggle with sin because we're in this flawed body. We're in this flawed world. Right? We're in Satan's world. Right? So sin is still a struggle. And this idea of working out salvation is deliverance from the power of sin. So this is something that Paul is exhorting the church to do corporately, is to accomplish their salvation from the power of sin. Right? And he says, do this with fear and trembling. Right? And this is the language of awe towards God, but it's also the language of fear of what happens if you aren't delivered from sin, if you fall into sin. Right? That's not something that we as believers should look forward to. Right? Remember, this is something that Christ died for, that God went through all of this work to raise up a Messiah to die to take care of the sin problem, so we shouldn't court it. Right? This is something that we look at and we don't want any part of. Right? So in the larger context of what we're talking about here in Philippians, he's talking about salvation from the particular sins of dissension, disharmony, the disunity. All right. And this is submission because of obedience to God's authority, God's majesty, God's power. All right. Verse 13. For it is God who is at work in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. All right. So now Paul gives his reason for this exhortation. God is working in the Philippians. Now, have we heard this before? Can anyone remember where? It's a tough question. Was in Philippians, maybe? Was in Philippians chapter 1, maybe? Verse 6? All right. Verse 6, Paul said that God has begun a good work in them. All right. And this, so here, he's still developing that idea that God is working in the Philippians. He is doing something with them. All right. They have not just been cast out on their own and left to drift. All right. God has started something and he is working in them. He says, for it is God who is at work at you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. So this is the two ways or ends towards that God is dealing in. So the first is this infinitive, to will. Right? And this is speaking of God's will in our theological terms. We use the language God's plan. All right? This is what God desires, and this is the goals that he has and he is working towards. And he is specifically working within the Philippians towards his greater plan for his purposes. All right, and that's a good thing. So he is shaping the Philippians to fill their role in his plan. And, then we have a second, to work for his good pleasure. Right, and the infinitive here, the word to work, right, implies a completed effect. Right, that God's will be successful. Yes, I realize I use the same word differently, back to back. God's will be successful as he's working in them. All right. And this is towards God's own good pleasure. All right. He is shaping them into his plan. He is working them, turning them into what pleases him. All right. And here we have to recognize, and I'm not going to go into this heavily, all right, but there's always this discussion of, well, if God's in control and God's doing stuff in this, then is God responsible for sin? No. Right? We can look right here at this verse and say the ways that God works within the believer is towards his pleasure and his good will, the things that he likes and he approves of. So the things that we do that fall short of that approval, say dissension, disharmony, disunity that Paul is talking, right, those are not the work of God. Those are actually resisting God's work in our life. So here, this is telling us specifically the kinds of things that God is working towards in the life of the Philippians here in Scripture, but for us generally, right, is towards the things that please him. This also means that we can't jump up and down and say, I did it, and try and take credit for what God is doing. No, this is God's work. Right? And that's a marvelous thing. Right? We can remain humble and let him take the glory. That's why we're here, to glorify him. Verse 14. Do all things without grumbling or disputing. All right, nice, short, sweet. All right. So this is talking more about how the Philippians are to work out that salvation, to accomplish that salvation. All right. And he gives a single command, do all things. All right, that's our command, do everything. All right, and then he gives a couple limiting factors. And so we have without, and then we have grumbling or disputing. And this word grumbling it's fraught with theological content. All right. Yes, theologians write that way. I occasionally speak that way. All right. But the idea is that there's a lot packed into this word grumbling, and we have to go back to the Old Testament. Or you go back to Exodus, and I've just given you one verse here that we see it in. But Exodus 16:7. In the morning you will see the glory of God, for he hears your grumblings against the Lord. And what are we that you grumble against us? All right, so here Moses is talking to the people of Israel. All right, and he's talking about their attitude towards God as it's expressed in their talking under their breath. All right, as they mumble and grumble and say, you know, I don't like this. I don't like that. Wasn't it better back in Egypt? They are discontent with what God has done. They are discontent with their present situation that they were in. Right? And they are expressing this discontent. All right, so that's Exodus 16:7. And that's the sense here. And that we see that go on and on and on in Exodus. And we see it again in Leviticus. All right, that's the language of grumbling. All right, and that's specifically what Paul is talking about. Now, even though he's talking about this to Gentiles. Right? These are Philippians, these aren't Jews. Right? But they should be familiar with these passages. Right? Paul was with them, he was teaching them from God's word. And he's saying, look back to that Exodus generation. You don't want to be like that group of people who were characterized by grumbling, by this expression of their discontent with God's glory. I mean, look at all the different things that God had done for the Jews, and they were discontent. Now, before we get on our high horse and say, well, we're the church and we're better, right, we'll talk about that next hour. Right? There's a lot to be said about how we are not better. Right? But he says here, do all things lacking this grumbling, aside from it. And the idea is don't let that be a part of your attitude towards life. Any aspect, do everything, right? And this is the full scope of what we do, right? And particularly in the focus of continuing to obey God, right? Working out our salvation, from the power of sin. Do everything with the right attitude. So this is not just a matter of doing the right thing. This is doing the right thing with the right attitude. Without grumbling, that's our own internal attitude. And then disputing, that's how we deal with other people. And the idea here is don't fight, don't argue. All right. This is verbal disharmony between people. And he's saying there's no place for that in the church. This is not, that's not a proper expression of our relationship with one another. That's not the proper working out of our relationship with God. Don't do that. So, and this is still part of just how Paul has been dealing with the Philippians. And we look back, he says, you're supposed to maintain the same mind, to maintain the same love, united in spirit, intent in one purpose. And arguing and disputing doesn't get you towards that goal. Don't do it. Verse 15. So that you will prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent, children of God above reproach, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. Wow, I did nice highlighting with that one. Among whom you appear as lights in the world. All right. So here we get to a purpose. And of course, Paul's got his nested purposes. All right. But so that you will... And it says, prove yourselves to be blameless. And I'm not sure that's the best translation here, but we'll deal with it. All right. But the idea is that if you act in this way, working out your salvation, accomplishing your salvation from the power of sin and fear and trembling, doing everything without grumbling or disharmony, or grumbling or dispute, there, when you act that way, all right, then there's not going to be any room for accusation against the Philippians. Right? And I realize I stepped ahead a little bit, but so there's a coherent flow of thought here. This is what Paul's talking about, that people from the outside will look in and not have any excuses to look and snicker and say, yeah, whatever, dude. Right. There's no reason for accusation. There's no discrediting of the Christian faith. There's no discrediting of your message to unbelievers. All right. And he does this with some really interesting language here. He says that you will become, all right, prove yourselves, but become, all right, blameless and innocent. So the first here, blameless, means without reason for accusation. No one can look at you and say, you are responsible for whatever. All right, so blameless. Second is innocent. Innocent is without guilt. All right, so nobody can point the finger at you because you haven't done anything. All right, that's pretty straightforward. All right. And here we have to recognize and look into the context. All right, this is, again, this Paul is not talking eternal salvation. He's not talking about how we stand before Christ at the judgment on the basis of our faith and his righteousness. It's not what he's talking about at all. Paul is talking about how we are right here, right now in this life, as we deal with unbelievers. He's saying that we can be and should be blameless. Innocent. All right. So he says, children of God above reproach. All right. So this is expanding on this, is explaining what he means by blameless and innocent. All right. Children of God. Right. We're familiar with that phrase. All right. But he's specifically drawing on the Philippians' relationship with God. And there's an inherent sense in then that as a child of God, one reflects the characteristics of the parent. All right, you look at my son, you see aspects of me, both good and bad. I'm sorry. All right. But you see the characteristics of the parent and the child. All right. And when Paul says children of God, he's talking about characteristics of God, particularly God's perfection, God's righteousness. Right. And as children of God, we are to reflect who our Father is. Right. So we should be innocent, or blameless, innocent, children of God. And then we have this phrase, above reproach. Now, in the Septuagint, later on, this is used as another word for blameless. All right. We see that especially in the Psalms. All right. But it gets that connotation of blamelessness from its use in the Pentateuch. All right. It's used in the law, all right, to indicate the perfect, unblemished state of the sacrificial animal. All right. The sacrifice, whether that is the sheep, the goat, the bull, the bird, whichever animal was being sacrificed, that animal must be perfect. All right, and we understand that. We understand that the sacrifice was a type. It looked forward to who Jesus Christ was when he died on the cross. All right, the fact that he himself was perfect. All right, so we understand that. We've seen that connection. We know that. All right, but here he says, children of God above reproach, using this language of the perfect sacrifice. Right? And Paul's talking to the Philippians. He's saying, you are to be without spot, without blemish. Right? And he's echoing language of Christ. Right? So just as Christ is the Son of God, you as children of God should, well, actually look like Christ as the perfect sacrifice. Right? And then he says, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, with my fancy highlighting there. Right? And here this is talking about society. All right? The people around the Philippians. The people that the Philippians dealt with on a daily basis, they were surrounded by the unbelievers. This is just talking about the world. Right? Now, but this is Paul, and he's using the language of the Old Testament again. Now imagine that. Paul, a Pharisee, quoting the Old Testament multiple times in the same passage. All right. This comes from Deuteronomy 32:5. This is commonly called the Song of Moses. All right. And there Moses writes, they have acted corruptly towards him. They are not his children because of their defect, but are a perverse and crooked generation. All right. And here, there's so many ties back and forth between what Paul is saying and what Moses said in Deuteronomy. I'm going to try and make those connections for you. All right, this word above reproach, this idea of unblemished, all right, stands in opposite to the defect that Moses mentions in this verse. And that's the idea of this is a lamb that cannot be sacrificed. This is a goat that cannot be offered to the Lord because it doesn't meet the criteria of perfection. Right. So it's unworthy, can't be used. In some sense, you could call it, for the purpose of worship, it's worthless. Right? And Paul is saying, when he says above reproach, that word right there, he's indicating the opposite of this. Right? Where the perfect, blameless, above reproach, spotless, without blemish, right, that's what the sacrifice was, and this is what wasn't sacrificed. So we get that contrast. And he says, they have acted corruptly towards God, right, Moses. They are not his children. So Moses speaking of these people that were, grumbling against God, grumbling against Moses. And Moses says they have acted corruptly against God. And then there's again another contrast. They are not his children. Paul says to the Philippians, yeah, don't be like that because you are God's children. Like I said, there are lots of ties back and forth here. All right, so there's supposed to be strong contrast now between the disharmony, disunity, the attitude of that Exodus generation and the Philippians who are supposed to be functioning in love, in harmony, in unity towards the purpose of the gospel as God's children without spot or blemish. In the midst of a perverse and crooked crooked and perverse generation. So as they're surrounded by unbelievers, they are different. They are not to be like the unbelievers around them, who are actually an awful lot like the Exodus generation. And that contrast, that as he paints this picture of this is what you are and this is what they are, right, that contrast then creates this situation that he says, among whom you appear as lights in the world. All right, so remember I said that that you're supposed to be without blame, without anyone being able to give you an accusation, above reproach, so that as these unbelievers look at the Philippians, they are supposed to see God. Supposed to see actually Christ, but the idea is that they get a reflection of God's glory and a picture at looking at the Philippians, who God is. Right? And then, you know, if you look through the Gospels, there's a lot of different places Jesus says, I'm the light of the world, right? And uses the language of light, and saying, I reflect God's glory. I provide a glimpse of who God is to the world. And Paul is using that same kind of imagery with the Philippians, saying, you're the only look, you're the only glimpse that these people around you are ever going to see of God. So don't let it be a tarnished image. Don't let it be a browned out image of God's glory. And here there's this implication that the world is in darkness. Again, we see that a lot. Jesus talks about that. John talks about that. The world is this picture of darkness. And here is this one beacon of light, this beacon of God's glory in the Philippian church. And that picture of God's perfection is marred when there's disunity, when there's disharmony, when Christians bicker with one another, when we argue, when we can't get along, when we can't show the love for one another that Jesus Christ showed for us, when we can't demonstrate the humility in keeping other people as more important than ourselves that characterized Jesus Christ when he was willing to put aside his prerogatives as God and take on the form of a slave who was willing to be obedient even to the point of dying. If we can't do that, what's that show to the world? That's what Paul's saying. They look at you. Wow. All right. This is a picture of what it is to be a Christian among unbelievers. They look at us. And so don't ever think that they aren't. Right? And we see it. Unfortunately, we see the image tarnished all too often. And notice how often that hits the news. Pastor falls, deacon falls, good Christian man murders. All right. The world notices when we do these things, when we tarnish the image of Christ. And they hold it up, they trumpet it. Right. So we don't give them opportunity. We remain blameless, innocent, above reproach. Verse 16, holding fast the word of life so that in the day of Christ I will have reason to glory because I did not run in vain nor toil in vain. All right, so this is going on talking about how this list of exhortations that the Philippians are doing, and this is part of it is holding on to the gospel. All right, he says the word of life, the word literally, the word which gives life. So they are to stick with the gospel. And remember, they were facing persecution. They had those that were opposing them. Paul's already talked about that at the end of chapter 1. He says, don't give up. Don't let the opponent win. Hold fast. Don't fall away. And there's the implication here that those who fall away from the gospel fail to be this beacon of light. They fail to remain blameless, right? Innocent. They aren't above reproach. And then Paul, being Paul with his nested purposes, so that in the day of Christ I will have reason to glory, because I did not run in vain nor toil in vain. All right, and Paul's again looking forward eschatologically. He's looking forward to a future time, All right. And he calls this time the day of Christ. We'll be talking about that in the next hour as well. All right. But this is, as Paul is explaining here, this is a time of judgment and reward for the believer. All right. And we see that in the language that Paul uses. Run in vain and toil in vain. Those are possibilities that in this day of Christ, Paul may have to stand before the Lord and say, yeah, no fruit. I did this and nothing came of it. So, but he says, that's not going to happen. That's not going to happen. All right. You hold on to the faith. Hold on, hold fast to the word of life, and the idea is cling tight and don't let go. All right. So that, in this time of reward and judgment, I will have reason, and the word here to glory, I don't know why somebody threw glory in here. Right, this is the word to boast, and we've had this word boast before, this very same word about the Philippians boasting in Paul. And he says, no, you really need to boast about Christ. But here he says, now, so in this day of judgment, I will have reason to boast about you. Right, and the idea here is boasting to God about them. Paul isn't saying, I've done this. Right, but Paul is saying, look at them. Look at them. They have done what you wanted to do. They were perfected through your work. Right. So, and the metaphor here we see there, Paul mixes metaphors, right? Running, toiling, all right. And this is both of these indicate the effort that Paul has put forth, that he has poured out into his relationship and his work with the Philippians. All right. And yet it's not Paul that ultimately determines if he's going to stand and say, yeah, no fruit. It's the Philippians. All right. They are the ones who will demonstrate whether or not that work has been of any value. Verses 17 and 18, but even if I am being poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrifice and service of your faith, I rejoice and share my joy with you all. You too, I urge you, rejoice in the same way and share your joy with me. Now we have a kind of a strange grammatical situation. Paul has another strong adversative conjunction, Allah, right? But not this, rather this. But then he does what's called a concessive. All right? He says, even though, right? And he's admitting, yes, this is the case. Even if I am being poured out as a drink offering. All right, and here Paul is again using the language of sacrifice. This whole passage is all about the Old Testament. All right, he says, even if I am being poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrifice and service of your faith. All right, and here Paul pictures not only his ministry, but here the present tense is, I am. And he's talking about his suffering in prison. Right, and he's there for the purpose of the gospel. We know about that. But he says, even though I am being poured out as a drink offering, my suffering that I am experiencing with the definite potential that this is going to end in death. All right, that's a reality. And Paul's not shrinking away from it. Matter of fact, remember he says, live as Christ and die as gain. All right. But he says, I am an offering. All right, and there's a very specific kind of offering. I'm a drink offering. And the imagery here is distinctive, all right, and it's positive. All right. He's not using the language here of himself in sacrificial death, even though his death is we know it does result from his imprisonment. All right. But the drink offering is described in Exodus 29, 40, and 41, and it was to be offered in conjunction with a sacrificial lamb. All right. And this drink offering is frequently expressed as producing a soothing aroma to God. And this offering, it was poured out on the altar to please God. And this is how Paul sees his suffering. He says, I am the drink offering, and what I am doing is a soothing aroma to God. So this is Paul's view of as positive. Even though it results in his death, that's not irrelevant, but that's not negative. This whole thing, his suffering, his imprisonment, is towards pleasing God. Oh, and remember, God works within people to his will and to his pleasure. All right. But the focus here is the fact that his sacrifice is complementary. The drink offering was not the main sacrifice. It went along with it. To use modern language, it's a side dish. All right. The main course here, so to speak, theologically speaking, is the sacrificial lamb. And that is how what he attributes to the Philippians. Notice this. He says, I'm being poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrifice and service of your faith. The Philippians, as a church, that's the main offering. So now we see this imagery where he says, innocent, blameless, spotless, without blemish, that word there. He's talking about them as they are the sacrifice. And he's just a complement to that. It's the Philippians that really count. And Paul is there just to add savor to it. So it's their faith and their service that is the sacrifice to God. And Paul uses that kind of language in Romans. We'll hit that another day. So he says, I rejoice and share my joy with you all. And so Paul shares his joy with the Philippians because of this state. And now, what does this say about pastors and congregations? Anyone? This is an open question. What does this passage tell us about pastors and congregations? Anybody? Yes, ma'am. That's a start. What else does this say?
The pastor is a complement to the congregation.
That's exactly what it says. What else? Now, there's a logical conclusion there.
We complement each other.
Yes, but that's saying the same thing. There's a logical conclusion to what Will just said. No, flip that around. The congregation is the main course. The work of the faith, the good works that the Lord has set before us, is focused on the congregation. The pastor's purpose is to complement that. The pastor, the Christian life doesn't center around the pastor and the church. The Christian life centers around y'all, not me. And the work of the faith is done by the many. And the pastor's job is to supplement that, to equip you, to train you towards that end. But the faith and the service is done on the body side. So the pastor is not the flashy part of the church. There shouldn't be. Church isn't about the pastor. The church is about the congregation. And Paul ends, he concludes, he says, you too. All right, not talking about the music group. He says, you too. I urge you, rejoice in the same way and share your joy with me. So, and Paul concludes with this exhortation. He says, I'm happy. I'm rejoicing in this situation where I'm being poured out, and I'm the complement. And this is how you should look at it too. You should have this same view that I have and share your joy with me. Joy is not for our own edification. We aren't just supposed to stand there and have little happy fits for ourselves. Right? No, joy is something that should be shared with others. Right? He says, I'm joyful in sharing it with you. Now, you should be joyful about all this and share it with me. And the idea is that both parties benefit from each other's joy. So with the thought of joy in mind, let's close in prayer. Our Father, we thank you for your graciousness in working your will in us, in forming us to fit our role in your plan, for working within us to produce your good pleasure. Father, we seek to serve you in your way, and we love you and rejoice in the fact that you have provided your Son that we could have faith in him and participate in your plan. The fact that you have graciously given us so many blessings, given us the image of Christ that we may imitate him, that we may follow him. Father, I pray that we would walk in the steps that you have laid before us, that we would do the good works you have prepared for us to do. We ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen.